All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am your host. Neil Dewing is taking a little bit of a break. He is going to be gone for the month of December, so he'll be incognito that entire time, but we'll still continue on here. And as always, if you like The Fifth Estate, if you like listening to this podcast, we ask that you go out there to iTunes, leave us a rating, leave us a review. It inflates our egos, and we appreciate it very much. So we are a few weeks into the Donald Trump transition, and there's been some interesting cabinet choices. There's been some interesting debates about different types of cabinet choices and some other decisions that have been made. And wanted to bring someone in to talk about this who's kind of been writing about it, and so thought, hey, let's go ahead and let's bring in somebody who knows something about that. He's from Commentary Magazine. Mr. Noel Rothman is here with us. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Jay. I appreciate it.
Sure. So let's start out with and we'll get into specifics here in a minute, but let's talk about just kind of an overall sense of the transition so far. Are you kind of underwhelmed? Are you surprised? Or are you more, this is kind of what you expected? What's your kind of your overall take on what you've seen so far?
Well, it's definitely not what I've expected. I don't know if it's what anybody expected, because who knows what to expect?
Right.
We don't have any inclination as to what this guy's going to do besides campaign trail rhetoric. And, other than that, just reading tea leaves and Kremlinology, and that's just it. So we don't know what's going to happen next. And to the extent that staffing is policy, I suppose there's some room for encouragement if you're a conservative who was a Trump skeptic in the campaign, as I was and am. There's some reason to be cheerful and other reasons to be fearful. I guess that's kind of the tale of it's the holiday season, so that rhymed and that was appropriate.
Yeah, but it was perfect.
That's kind of where I'm at. I guess individually, the picks are you can discuss them, as individuals, as a comprehensive whole. I don't think there really is much of a story here to tell that makes sense. It's all over the map.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the first two appointments that he made, first one was Reince Priebus to be his chief of staff, and then Steve Bannon to be kind of he has the role that Valerie Jarrett has in the Obama administration, kind of like this overall guy who's going to drive not necessarily policy but kind of advise President Trump on a range of issues, and there's obviously been some issues with the choice of Steve Bannon.
Right. So that was that announcement gave the Beltway set, hope for the future. And for me, it was just soul crushing, because your analogy is perfect. It's Valerie Jarrett and Rahm Emanuel. It's Karl Rove and Andy Card. The chief of staff pick in Reince Priebus doesn't have any executive experience, but he does know the party and he knows Washington and knows how to navigate it. And if those analogies held true, that it was Steve Bannon was the functional equivalent of Rove or Jarrett, then it would be Steve Bannon dictating the agenda and Reince Priebus skillfully executing it. And that would be terrifying from a perspective of somebody who's not enthralled with the burn it down alt-right populist anti-establishmentarian view that is the Breitbart Bannon wing of the party. But in the interim, what you've seen since has been, to the extent we can say this, because it's very early and it might be prejudging the situation, but it doesn't appear as though Steve Bannon has had very much influence over the transition process based only in staffing decisions. And I say that from the perspective of who he's chosen for his Treasury Secretary, who's a Goldman Sachs alum. His Wilbur Ross is certainly a protectionist, but he's also not necessarily of the variety that I think Breitbart would be appreciative of. Governor Haley's ascension to the United Nations post, which is still a cabinet level post, according to transition officials. Barack Obama elevated it to a cabinet post. It wasn't prior. It's enjoyed some status along those lines in earlier administrations. As far as I understood it, Steve Bannon wanted Democratic Representative Tulsi Gabbard from Ohio, who's uncautiously repeated Russian propaganda, has suggested that we should ally ourselves with Assad, has been as anti-neoconservative as you can expect somebody to be, in verging on conspiratorial terms. That was his pick. And to the extent that these people have been rejected, is certainly heartening from the perspective of the vanilla Republican who's interested in continuity and maintaining America's role in the world.
Yeah, there's been, I think one of the funniest things that I've watched, I don't know if it's ha-ha funny, but it's been amusing to me to watch is everything happening with Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney is of course, hated by the hardcore Trump supporters. Largely because of, the things that, Trump, Romney had said about Trump during the campaign. Of course, having that big televised event where he went into how bad it would be if Trump was elected president. And now that he's on the verge of, maybe choosing him as Secretary of State, maybe not, but even considering him and going out to dinner with him and everything has kind of gotten the Trump people really in an uproar. I mean, Kellyanne Conway, who claimed she wasn't speaking for herself, but still the way she was on television talking about, how Trump supporters and loyalists saw this as a major betrayal of their support to even consider Mitt Romney is something. It was something to watch. And I think Trump kind of likes that, though. Don't you agree?
Oh, yes. He certainly likes that. I mean, he's definitely... He manages in that style, which is to say that he doesn't really manage. He sort of pits people against each other in the arena and watches them compete for his affections, which is a rather difficult style of management for the federal government. I mean, it might work in the private sector. It certainly didn't work just judging by Donald Trump's own ability to navigate the private sector himself. And the guy in the 1990s managed to lose $1 trillion and was living off the charity of his bankers who managed to put him on an allowance.
Yeah, one of whom was Wilbur Ross.
Correct, exactly. Yes. So what goes around comes around. But that being said, Ms. Conway's approach to trying to kill Romney in public has been rather remarkable, and it certainly hasn't ended with Mitt Romney coming out and basically giving Donald Trump what he wanted, to the extent that we understood what he wanted in private reports, which was an acknowledgement that essentially all the very caustic criticisms that he leveled of Donald Trump's personality, his behavior, his understanding of geopolitics, that was all wrong, and he was incorrect to make those judgments. So Mitt Romney kind of gave him that after they had dinner the other night. He came out and spoke to the press and said, look, Donald Trump did what I couldn't do. He won the election. He won states I couldn't win. I've been very encouraged, and I feel like he's going to be the person to lead us into the future. He got what he wanted. But Kellyanne Conway's attacks on him haven't stopped. This morning, she retweeted something that I had posted a couple days ago, a very no-commentary posting of two maps, the 2008 and the 2016 results of the House elections alone, to contrast how much territory Democrats have ceded to Republicans over the course of the Obama presidency, which has been dramatic. And her response to this was, this says it all. In the four elections since he won in 2008, only in 2012 against Romney went President Obama's way. Massive losses in 2010, 2014, and 2016. Now, this is factually inaccurate. Democrats won seats in 2016, as they did won seats in 2012. But it was Kellyanne Conway's mission at this point not to say that Barack Obama has been a failure and that the Democratic Party is facing a 100-year nadir of its power, but that Mitt Romney's the problem. It's verging on personal. It's certainly coming from the top, because this is echoed as well by people like Chris Collins, a New York representative, one of the very early backers of Donald Trump in the Congress. So this is precisely what Donald Trump wants to see, and if that is what he wants to see, I doubt very strongly that he wants Mitt Romney to occupy this position. It suggests to me that he just really wants to humiliate him. But I can't really prejudge it, because he has definitely made it clear that he's not staffing him, you know, entirely with sycophants at this point. Governor Haley was just as critical during the campaign. So I'm not entirely sure if he won't be persuaded by the voices around him who desperately want Mitt Romney to sort of curb his really dangerous impulses, future President Donald Trump's dangerous impulses when it comes to foreign policy. They want to see Mitt Romney there as sort of a backstop. And that might win the day, but it seems like, to the extent that Donald Trump has any influence over this, it is to try to humiliate him and to force some sort of capitulatory behavior from Mitt Romney.
Well, that would be, I mean, seriously, you're in the midst of transitioning. You know, you've just won, you know, this election. You're going to be the president of the United States. And if you're right, I mean, if that's what Donald Trump is doing, that he's orchestrating all of this, you know, behind the scenes in order just to embarrass Mitt Romney, it's you know, I get a little nervous about, you know, what are you going to do when you're president of the United States if you feel you've been slighted by somebody? You know, it's kind of a dangerous game to be playing. But you're right, it seems odd, because at first, you know, there was word that, you know, Donald Trump was furious at Kellyanne Conway for doing what she's doing, but she's continued to do it. So, you know, obviously, if he wanted her to stop, he would call her in and say, hey, knock it off. I'm seriously considering choosing this guy. And it's my decision. So do me a favor. Stop going out there and second guessing me, you know. But you're right. I don't see any of that. So it's kind of odd. So he just made the announcement of who he wants to be his defense secretary, General James Mattis, who a lot of people are thrilled about. There's, you know, this, from what I've seen, for the most part, it seems across the board, people are happy with this choice. The only one I've seen come out and say that he shouldn't be, and I guess there's Democrats who are maybe trying to mount some opposition to him in the Senate. Kirsten Gillibrand has said that she's going to vote against the they have to get a waiver in order to, because he's only been, I think, active duty. You have to be out of active duty for 7 years, and he's only been out for about 3 years. So they have to rewrite the law to allow him in, which hasn't been done since, you know, the 1950s or something like that. So what about Mattis? And, you know, since this is, you know, this is probably one of the first few times when a, you know, a military person has been, you know, selected to lead this post, when usually it's more of a civilian person because they want civilian control of the military. So how are you seeing this one?
Well, I think that Gillibrand's sort of reflective of an impulse on Democrats' part to say, you know, which fight are we going to pick here? Because this is the easiest one from the perspective of an institutional procedural process. They actually need a vote. Democrats don't have any ability to block any of these cabinet posts. They nuked the filibuster for lower level and judicial and executive positions. So all they can do is sort of wince and whine about it and make stuff painful in the form of, you know, drawing out hearings, calling a bunch of outside witnesses, making a stink about some, you know, guys that may be unacceptable, guys and ladies that may be unacceptable. Particularly to Democrats. So that's basically all they have. This is the real big, you know, buy-in that they have. They need an actual vote on this thing. So I think that's more of just sort of a perfunctory keeping the door open to making this sort of difficult on Donald Trump in the form of getting the cabinet picks he wants, which, by the way, is a delicious turn of events, because this sort of really standard operating procedure on the part of a minority party was deemed outright treasonous when it was Republicans who had almost no authority in 2009. They had 41 votes in the Senate until July of 2009, when Arlen Specter switched parties. And they had, you know, there was this book, this Robert Draper book, who's a New York Times Magazine contributor, who wrote in 2012 that Republicans had a meeting on the night of Inauguration Day to plan the ways in which they would oppose Barack Obama. And it was outright scandalous that they had the notion that, for example, Senator John Kyle at the time, who was at this meeting and talked about the ways in which they could interview Tim Geithner and, you know, cross-examine him on the allegations that he had failed to pay Medicaid and Social Security taxes when he was at the IMF. And that came up in confirmation hearings. And this collaboration was just scandalous. that they would dare to actually oppose a nominee submitted by not only the first black president of the United States, but somebody who was a president in the midst of a financial crisis, which, by the way, was Bush's fault. And all this stuff was just, you know, just piled on, this partisan nonsense. And the fact that Democrats are now behaving like a minority party behaves, and nobody's particularly scandalized by it, is really, you know, par for the course.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, yeah, Chuck Schumer has already come out and, you know, we're back to the days of when the Republican Party hates grandma and grandpa. And
I said, a war on seniors.
The war on seniors. Yeah, we're back to that.
At least their seventh war. This is a really multi-front yeah. multi-front battle. We're picking fights all over the place.
Yeah, this is like the Crusades, you know, for against the seniors. It's been, you know, right. It's been forever. You know, Ronald Reagan was the first, and then you know, it's been next other generations of people who've been warring on seniors.
Sure. But as far as Mattis goes, yeah, he's the real deal. He's, you know, he's a warrior's warrior, a scholar. A real sharp guy. I mean, there's a lot of he's famous for a lot of these quips. But you know, anybody who knows, who's worked under him, has served under him, they know him to be, you know, a general's general. So I do suspect that he's going to get confirmed. I think Senator Gillibrand is probably picking the wrong fight here. But like I said, I understand why she's trying to keep the party's options open. They're probably better served trying to, as Byron York said, Ashcroft a few of these nominees and render them toxic by virtue of some really difficult confirmation hearings than they are, you know, planting a flag on Mattis's nomination, who enjoys really bipartisan consensus, is just a generally good person for this post.
Yeah, and of course, you know, like you said, the rank and file seem to love this guy. I mean, I've read a number of articles already about people who have served with him or served, you know, under him. And, you know, there's been nothing but praise. I mean, there's just nothing, there's not a bad word being said about him. So to try and kind of like drag him down during the confirmation process is going to be a little ridiculous. I think they'll probably have more success maybe against Jeff Sessions in that kind of regard. But even then, that's going to be a little harder. Some of these picks so far, I think Democrats are really frustrated because they were expecting, you know, fire breathing kind of, you know, conservatives or people with a lot of controversy behind them, and they just don't have that. And I almost think it's frustrating them a little bit. Let me ask you about this though, because this is interesting. You know, if they're this little victory tour that Donald Trump is doing, you know, one of these things that I'm kind of shaking my head about this is that if Barack Obama had done this in 2008 after he defeated, before he was even, you know, inaugurated, if he had decided to go on some kind of victory tour, or he did it in 2012 after his reelection campaign, conservatives would have went out of their mind, you know, with outrage about something like that. And then here's Donald Trump actually going out and saying, I'm doing it. I'm going to go to these, you know, he loves the rallies, going to go to these things where there's 18,000 people screaming for him and he's having a good time and everyone's like, this guy's not even in office yet.
Well, I mean, Barack Obama sort of did do something along these lines, and it did generate quite a bit of frustration among Republicans, even though it really wasn't all that controversial. He went on a post-election whistle-stop tour, which is actually something that, you know, presidents do on their way to Washington. He hopped on a train from Illinois and did a series of stops along the way to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration. That's not uncommon. What Republicans had a real problem with was after the election, Barack Obama did not receive any deference from Republicans. Republicans were in a very narrow minority position. They had, as I said, 41 votes in the Senate until July when they had 40, and there's a filibuster-proof majority of Democrats in the Senate. Republicans had like 174 votes, something along those lines, in the House, really almost nothing. They couldn't mount any effective opposition, so they played a pretty deft hand. They played a bad hand very well insofar as they gave Barack Obama almost no support and Democrats no support for legislation that was even remotely controversial. Big ticket items were passed very much along party lines with a few exceptions, a couple of defectors here and there. But that ended up being very smart policy, and the Democrats hemmed and hawed about that. But they didn't give anybody any legitimacy, and they deprived Republican constituencies of any of the goodies. So Republicans were very much on the outs in this process. And when they didn't get what they wanted, Barack Obama hit the stump. In 2009 and 2010, he did a lot of rallies, a lot of very partisan speeches in places with big audiences. He capitalized on his popularity very much, and Republicans called it the permanent campaign. Right. It was very divisive, very hard to make government work. I mean, I think if you remember back in negotiations over the health care bill, about February of 2010, there was this big health care summit where they had Republicans and Democrats gathered together. It was broadcast live on C-SPAN, and it was the very famous moment where Barack Obama lectured Republicans about whether or not they had any authority. That was the "I won" line. You know, like, you lost. If you want to go, you know, get your ideas out there, go win elections. And so that he used Republicans really as a foil to demonstrate that he didn't really need them, and that they were, you know, being obstructionist in this new progressive era and impediments to progress generally. And if that's what Donald Trump does, I mean, he's going to have a lot of trouble getting legislation passed because Democrats are in a much stronger position than Republicans were in 2009. But he's borrowing from Barack Obama's playbook almost explicitly, and the fact that they're chafing under it and not recognizing that this pattern was already set and established by his predecessor. I mean, it's just sort of like hard to have any sympathy for that point of view. This is, you are reaping what you've sowed.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I don't feel sorry for Democrats. I mean, I'm just, you know, it's just, I always, you know, caution people to keep some perspective about these things. You know, so, I mean, it's like, you know, it's a similar situation where, you know, he's chosen Elaine Chao to be his transportation secretary. And of course, you know, there's all the talk of the $1 trillion infrastructure bill that he wants. And of course, he needs to be able to get it through the Senate. Well, of course, she's married to Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. I still think that bill is going to be harder to get through the House than it's going to be to get through the Senate. But, you know, there are cases such as that where people, you know, would have been, you know, a little bit angrier. At the same time, I also say that I'm probably not as upset about something like that because I really didn't have much expectations for Donald Trump. I mean, my expectations were very, very low. So if you're going to nominate somebody who's shown to be competent in the past in a government role, and she was as the labor secretary, I mean, if you mention her name around, you know, labor leaders, they start twitching. You know, but what about that? I mean, you know, the whole drain the swamp kind of thing, that whole theme, are you seeing? It seems to me that there's some of that is kind of gone away, especially with some of the choices that he's making. But at the same time, you say, well, he's picking the right people who know these systems. If he really does want to reform them, if you get somebody, you want to reform the banking system, you don't go out and get, you know, you don't pick a protester to do it. You pick somebody who knows the system in order to sit there and say, okay, if you're going to change it, this is what you need to do.
No, he didn't pick anybody. I mean, this is all nonsense. No, Trump supporters don't want to drain the swamp. They don't. They want affect. They want, and this is going to be very rude. I'm sorry to Trump supporters who have a huge chip on their shoulder about their class status. But you don't have any interest in policy. None. Donald Trump is picking Steve Mnuchin for his Treasury Secretary. The guy's a movie financier.
Right.
He doesn't have any. He's not being chosen because he's a reformer. He's being chosen because he knows a little bit about the system, and he's a Trump ally. That's it. And that's all that made everybody happy. Nobody's up in arms about Steve Mnuchin on the Trump side. They're really frustrated by Mitt Romney's possible pick for Secretary of State, but it has nothing to do with corruption. Mitt Romney doesn't have a corrupt bone in his body. The guy's as charitable as anybody, on anybody in this country. He's really a decent human being who actually does know quite a bit about foreign policy to the extent that everybody knows anything about foreign policy in this position. As governor of a state, Mitt Romney has a fair bit of foreign policy chops. He ran as a foreign policy president, really, in 2012, insofar as he has a vision that was contrasting with Barack Obama's. It wasn't on healthcare, that's for sure. So, you know, the fact that that's really frustrating Trump backers has nothing to do with the fact that they want to drain the culture at the State Department at Foggy Bottom, which really desperately needs an overhaul. Foggy Bottom is a place packed with career diplomats who view process as its own end, who are deeply suspicious of American foreign policy objectives. That place needs to be gutted. And it's not going to be, no matter who he picks. And nobody cares about that. It's all about affect. It's all about whether or not Mitt Romney bent the knee to Donald Trump during the primaries, because that's all they want. They want to see deference to the notion that this is a great aggrieved class that is due some comeuppance from certain people. They want a pound of flesh. It has nothing to do with any sort of culture or reform or the trajectory of the country or anything along those lines. It has everything to do with a sense of grievance and a demand for restitution.
Right. And we're seeing that right now in Indiana with I just totally lost the name of the company, the air conditioning company.
Carrier,
where, you know, Mike Pence is, you know, was the governor there. And, you know, Donald Trump made this announcement, hey, they're going to keep, you know, 1,000 jobs here in the United States. And I told you this was going to happen. And, you know, of course, as the days have gone on, the more details have come out about it. And now it turns out that, you know, it's largely their biggest incentive was that they're going to get a bunch of tax breaks from the state in order to keep people there. So, but the thing is, and like you said, they don't really, you know, Trump supporters don't really care. And I've seen people say this, like, who cares? The jobs are staying here. It doesn't matter. You know, because they're not, you know, they're targeting this company for specific tax breaks to keep people there. It's not an overall policy of tax policy and regulatory reform that they're going to say. The state said, hey, we'll help you out. And they were like, okay, now we'll do it. But people don't seem to care, you know, and somebody says, well, look, this is a cylinder on a smaller scale. You're not really creating or keeping jobs here through policy. It's more of a payoff. But you, like you said, people don't seem to care about it, whether one way or the other. They're just sitting there. It's something that they can, like you said, it's a piece of that pound of flesh that they want.
Yeah, and it's not like this is unheard of policy on the state level.
Right.
I mean, you had recently Nikki Haley had offered a company something along those lines, a very, you know, an incentive package to stay in the state. Larry Hogan just very famously offered several million dollars in tax breaks to Marriott, Northrop Grumman, to keep their headquarters in Maryland. But, you know, this is crony capitalism, GOP style, and it's not really rare to see that sort of thing. It's certainly not efficient economics. But if you're doing this sort of behavior, at least pick firms that have a big, broad constituency. I mean, we're talking about a firm now where we have one factory that was politically convenient to the incoming administration, and we're keeping all of 850 jobs to the tune of, you know, $7 million in tax abatements over the course of an indeterminate period of time, which is, you know, relatively okay as far as, you know, the cost per job at about $7,000 in tax breaks per job to taxpayers, if you can call it a cost to taxpayer, considering it's their own money. But it's not really that bugs me so much as it is the contingencies that are strapped to it. The deal is contingent on whether or not Carrier and UT, which is a defense contractor that owns Carrier, makes about $6 billion off the federal government per annually. The contingencies are employment rates and retention and arbitrary levels of capital investment. All of this is dictated by the state. I mean, it's certainly not laissez-faire economics, but we're past the point of laissez-faire economics here. The GOP, according to Donald Trump, is no longer a free market economic policy. And that's just, you know, I'm just quoting Vice President Pence at this point, who is actually, you know, he was giving interviews to the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times recently. And the Journal said, I'm quoting now, that the Trump White House would eschew many of the free market principles that have guided prior Republican administrations, including injecting itself into the personal long-term operating decisions of individual companies, as in there are more Carrier deals forthcoming. And we had Mike Pence himself, who told the New York Times, quote, the free market has been sorting it out and America's been losing. That's his view of free market economics.
Oh,
now.
I saw that.
It wasn't his view of free market economics yesterday. or the day before, or all of his career, when he's described himself as a conservative first, a Republican second, voted against every single market-distorting package that Democrats submitted to the Congress in 2010 and 2009, the 111th Congress. He was very much a voice for free market economics and Reaganism and the sort of vibrancy that comes from the creative destruction of capitalism. Not anymore. Now it's a Trump party. We are all populists, according to Stephen F. Moore, the founder of Club for Growth. This isn't Reagan's party anymore, according to the founder of Club for Growth. It's Donald Trump's populist party, and we all better get in line. That is so corrupting. That is so repulsive, that kind of moral cowardice. And it has really turned this party into something that I don't think it is and isn't really sustainable in the long term. America can't have two progressive parties. Right. It just won't last long. Democrats will outdo you if you're going to be a progressive. Democrats will outbid you on progressive appeal. So Donald Trump was able to win as a progressive in a era that is populist and progressive when the headwinds were at, you know, his back, and or where the headwinds were at Republican or Democrats' face, and there were tailwinds at Republicans' back.
Right.
And he won by fewer than 100,000 votes in places that Republicans have been trying to win for 30 years. So it looks on the map like he did a spectacular job, you know, getting that white working class vote out, as well as a couple of minority votes too, more minority votes than a lot of people thought he would get. But is that going to be there in 4 years? I mean, we got to show some real tangible progress here. And this, if he thinks like a developer in terms of big infrastructure projects, big Soviet-style infrastructure projects, and individual companies, and talks about jobs saved on the trail in 2020, you know, is that going to cut it? And what will Republicans have cost? What will Republicans have sacrificed if that's their message going forward?
Yeah. I mean, if you look, China's you know, he's always talking about China, but China, you know, kind of inflated their economic growth with infrastructure projects. They have highways that nobody's driving on, you know, office buildings that they've constructed that nobody's occupying. And so, you know, you're right. And it's a dangerous game to play, because one of the biggest critics of the carrier deal that has worked out is Bernie Sanders, who's screaming about it, you know, because he's saying that, you know, it's great that the jobs are there, but basically they're paying them off by giving tax cuts to the rich. You know, it's the usual Bernie Sanders stuff. They're not, you know, focusing on the worker. This is more for the big businessman. And you're right. And so when it comes down to it, you know, in 4 years, I mean, I don't even want to start talking about 4 years from now, to be perfectly honest with you, but you know, it's like it is setting it up for that kind of thing. But
focusing on the worker would have been to let Carrier go, because these workers would have been better off in the near term. They'd have been fired, and that would have been terrible. But in the very longer term, they would have found better jobs, because there would have been more efficient companies replacing these jobs that aren't going to replace them now. And we're not going to see that kind of economic activity. Look, Chrysler could have gone bankrupt, really could have. And it would have. It's not like those factories would have been dormant forever. We have Honda in this country. We have Toyota in this country. We had Ford that didn't need a bailout, but figured it was better off for its political future if it were to take and restructure along these lines in order for it to have access to the kind of capital that was available in the form of TARP funds.
Right.
So these kind of market distorting efforts, they don't advance the economy. It's zero sum economics. And eventually the market, you know, the business cycle returns, and the benefits that you have had from these very temporary offsets go away. And we're going to see that again very soon. Indiana now just bought itself, according, you know, I'm quoting Scott Linsacombe here over at Cato Institute, is a very bright trade guy. Indiana just bought itself an inefficient factory. Great. So now these people have their jobs and they're stuck there. They're stuck in this inefficient job, making what they're going to be continuing to making for the foreseeable future. That's not how this thing is supposed to work. And conservatism, free market economic conservatism, laissez-faire supply-sider kind of stuff, that's the philosophy is antithetical to what we're seeing out of Donald Trump now. And it's just really tragic that we're seeing a lot of people who know that pretend otherwise.
Right. Well, that's the difficult part is separating what is pro-business from what is pro-free market. And, you know, that's where Republicans are going to run into trouble. And it's where they've been running into trouble, is that, you know, you're if you're, you know, this one may seem good at first because, you know, they're saying 1,000 people are going to keep their jobs instead of it going to Mexico. But you're right. Over the long term, it's going to do more harm than good because, you know, those efficiencies aren't there. And I've argued that, you know, people have to stop with this fantasy that these manufacturing jobs, these kind of low-level manufacturing jobs that normally in, you know, late 1940s, early 1950s, were good enough to pay somebody well enough that they could buy a house and raise a family. It's just not, they're not coming back. You know, automation has changed so much of this and it's made it easier. And either people are going to get pushed out because they're moving these jobs to Mexico or somewhere else, or they're going to get automated. We saw this, we see this now. If you look, perfect example is McDonald's in the Seattle area, where the minimum wage is being raised to $15 an hour. They're saying, okay, you're going to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. We're going to eliminate people that are going to have to take your order, and you can just order through a kiosk. And there'll still be people there to make your Big Mac, but there's nobody. You know, now you don't have to worry about giving your order to somebody because those people aren't going to be there anymore because we have to eliminate those jobs.
Yeah, the McDonald's example is a good example of a minimum wage job, but I mean, you could also go higher. I mean, there's really high pay manufacturing jobs in this country. Manufacturing productivity is up.
Yes.
It's just that the jobs aren't so much there because of automation. Right. The people who have jobs in manufacturing, they do quite well for themselves, quite well. But there's just fewer jobs available as a result of, as you say, automating pressures. I encounter more resistance to this among, and I feel like it's very generational, that the notion that your job should support your family is one that has eluded politicians for a long time, because making that promise a reality has become difficult, and it's one that Donald Trump has promised, and it resonates powerfully, but it's not going to be deliverable because what he's promised is the repeal of the 21st century. It's just not going to happen. And I sense when I talk to people who are a generation older than me, a baby boomer generation primarily, that as much as cultural revanchism is a big part of this, the idea that they no longer recognize the country that they're in, the sweeping transformational social changes have been too much, too quick to absorb. And I'm sympathetic to that because I actually sense that as well. Although I'm less frustrated by it, I do get that we've had a very rapid cultural transformation over the course of the Obama presidency. But the economic arguments are much more nostalgic than I think they're even willing to admit, and they're not going to come to pass. I mean, we're not going to see the return of manufacturing in this country to the, you know, on a scale that we saw in the late 1950s and early 1960s. It's just not going to happen.
No.
And you can have tax code reform, and it's going to be freeing up a lot of capital in this country to make some capital investments. But those capital investments aren't necessarily going to go towards manufacturing. And if you have a tax holiday from funds that are abroad to repatriate them, they're not going to go to investments. They go to dividends. They go into the pockets of people who have been hiding that money offshore in order to evade taxes. I mean, that's sort of a democratic line, but it is the truth. I mean, it's observable. So it's not as though we can demand that there be capital investments unless you do what Donald Trump and Governor Pence did in Indiana, which is tether that to some sort of an arrangement that is both carrots and sticks. It is, you will do this and you will get taxpayer abatement for it, or we will punish you in the form of punitive taxes in the tax code.
Right.
And that's not conservatism. That's not republicanism. It's not even really any form of democratic governance that I'm familiar with. It's socialism.
Ooh, now you've hit somebody hard. Now people are going to complain. You use the socialism word, but you're right. I mean, that's the whole thing. And you know, I think what's funny is when you look at, you know, Josh Earnest, who has been asked about this, about the carrier deal, and other Democrats who are basically saying, well, you know, Donald Trump only needs to do this, you know, 155 more times or whatever it may be to equal the amount of jobs that President Obama has, you know, saved, you know, with his policies or something like that.
Saved, created preserved.
Yeah.
Looked upon favorably.
It's created or saved. That's been the new thing. It's like you can count you're a job creator if you keep a job from going to Mexico or something like that. Which is kind of odd. So yeah. Let's wrap it up here. Let's make a prediction. All right. And God knows, you know, I was saying
so good at that.
Exactly. I was saying the same thing. I said, I was on a show last night and I said, I've just been horrible about this. So, cause they were asking the question that I'm going to ask you, who is ultimately going to get the, Secretary of State position?
You know, I can't do it, Jay. I won't do it. I've been wrong about this the whole time. I'm going to keep being wrong. I don't know. I tell you who I want. I want Mitt Romney to be in that position.
Okay.
I think that he deserves to be in that position. I don't think Giuliani deserves to be in that position. I think if they put David Petraeus in that position, they will be laughed off the stage as they deserve to be. I mean, the notion that we put a guy who mishandled classified in as the Secretary of State and have his probation officer come in and check the computers, that's insane. Which, by the way, we didn't get the chance to talk about NSA Director Mike Flynn, who is absolutely terrifying in his position. The guy is not – he's a tough thinker. He's kind of maligned in his role at DIA, but he also put in a secret internet cable for himself. And I'm deeply concerned that because of his conspiratorial mind and his relationship with the Kremlin, that our intelligence sharing capabilities are going to be compromised, that foreign nations that are deeply suspicious of Moscow are going to be reluctant to share intelligence with us, and that's going to make us less safe. That's something I absolutely believe is forthcoming.
Well, and plus his praise for people like Mike Cernovich and for Milo Yiannopoulos publicly on Twitter is just another thing that makes me wonder what is this guy thinking? You know, when he's praising those idiots.
Yeah, he's very conspiratorial.
Yeah.
And this is the person who's going to be advising the president on immediate threats to American national security.
It
is a bad situation. His deputy, KT McFarlane, is a much more circumspect, sharp person. I like her. I know her. She's been out of government since the Reagan administration. I don't know whether or not she's going to perform in that role, but she gives me a little bit of comfort. But Mike Flynn's position as NSA is deeply disturbing. I'm not sure who else is up for that role. Oh, Dana Rohrabacher, I suppose, who would be just as bad. Vladimir Putin's favorite congressman, who bizarrely thinks that the Anschluss of the Crimean Peninsula was legitimate and ratified legitimately in a hastily prepared referendum that nobody observed, but yet Dana Rohrabacher thinks was totally legitimate, more so than the OSCE. So who knows where he's getting his information from? I can guess. But beyond that, everybody else is pretty poorly qualified for that position, with the exception of Mitt Romney.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because somebody asked me last night, they were like, well, you know, they think it'll be John Bolton or Mitt Romney. And I said, because I've been wrong so often going back to this, I said, I'm going to sit there and say John Bolton, so maybe I'll be wrong again, and he'll actually offer the job to Mitt Romney. And people have been questioning his foreign policy experience, but it's just kind of like, well, you know, there's certain things that he's done. And like you said, his 2012 campaign was centered around a lot of it on foreign policy. It was the Olympics. But what he did, you know, with the Olympics in Salt Lake City was, you know, pretty remarkable with such a corrupt organization. So, you know, I we're talking about somebody who's level headed, who's very smart and, you know, can do the job. I mean, basically, you're talking about going into these areas and talking to these people. It's diplomacy. That's the whole point. And you're right. I mean, Petraeus is a terrible choice for the reasons that you outlined. And, you know, John Bolton is good to watch on shows like Red Eye and stuff like that. But I don't think at this point he's meant to be in a position. You know, we have, you know, very kind of you know, it's touch and go around the world with a lot of different things. And I'm not sure he's the right guy to do that.
I would be okay. I think he's more of a DepSec kind of character to me, but I would be okay with John Bolton as Secretary of State. And I'll tell you why. For the same reasons that I'm okay with Mitt Romney as Secretary of State, their belief in executive style leadership in a diplomatic capacity. I got my grad degree in international affairs and diplomatic relations. I have actually a diplomacy degree. And one of the problems with diplomacy that diplos don't want to acknowledge is that they view process as its own end. Engagement. Engagement alone is its own end. It's not. Engagement is a problem. Engagement makes things worse. Engagement is the peace process, which has only made peace inevitably harder to reach. And invariably gives bad actors cover and makes good actors compromised. Process is a problem. Results are good. Diplomacy should be about results. And the State Department of Foggy Bottom is full of processors and very few people who are interested in results. And I would be just fine with John Bolton in that role, because he would stiffen the spines of quite a few people in that very comfortable institution.
And perhaps that's why they're nervous.
Who deserve to be made nervous, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Noah Rothman for Secretary of State, everyone. How's that sound?
I don't think I'd be confirmable.
All right. Well, Noah, thank you so much for being on the show. It was great to get your insight. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And everybody can find your work over at Commentary Magazine. And where can they find you on Twitter and where else?
You can find me on Twitter at Noah C. Rothman. And I have a Facebook page at Noah C. Rothman, but that's about it.
There you go. But that's all anybody needs. Yeah, but read them at Commentary. It's terrific. Your writing is excellent.
Thank you, sir.
It's really well done. And you guys have your own good podcast over there too as well. I've listened to that a number of times. And I'm not a big podcast listener. I co-host one, but I don't listen to a lot of them. But yours is very well done. So good work. Keep that up.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
All right, Noah, thank you. And thank you, everyone. We appreciate you listening. Again, go out to iTunes on the Fifth Estate. Give us a rating. Give us a review. We like hearing that. And we will see you next time here on the Fifth Estate.